Well, I'm really curious to know what you think you're getting into today, but so today and tomorrow, talking about Roman Empire and American Empire. And the reality is, for early Christianity, that it grew up in the shadow of the Roman Empire. And a lot of our sense of the vitality of early Christianity has to do with its resistance against the Roman Empire. It was not easy to resist Rome's culture and values, never mind official violent persecution, whether at the local level or at the empire-wide level. Today, we live in the great empire of our day. And our empire, America, has strong cultural values. It has a way of doing business. It has a certain way of thinking about the world and how the world works. And what challenges does that pose to Christian faith? And so that's what we want to be exploring during our time. And so during this, I'm going to be drawing on some work that's done by New Testament scholars and historians who've looked at the New Testament and made connection between the New Testament and the Roman Empire, some of the language that the Roman Empire used. Okay, and so my goal over the 2 days, I do want to look at some big issues of empire. But I really want to move, and especially more tomorrow, but moving more towards the local and the personal and even the relational. Okay? So really bring it down close to a personal level. I come to this as a partial insider, partial outsider. I grew up in Canada, as Cliff said, and but despite growing up in Canada, I had American parents. And there was a certain part of me, my identity, that was American. So I had a lot of interest in American things, would do a lot of reading that my friends in Canada would not do. And that's because my family was American. When we went on trips to see family, we came down to Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, okay, down to this part of the world. My mom would tell me stories about the U.S. Civil War, about our family, and some really fascinating stories. And so that piqued my interest in the Civil War. But at the same time, even as a teenager, I knew that I was being shaped by Canadian ways of thinking about the world. Okay, so there was something of a tension there between those two. And I'll tell you a quick story about one time that was made evident to me. It was when I was an undergraduate student at Harding, and Harding has the American Studies program, where they bring in these eminent speakers, and the Benson Auditorium is packed. And on this particular occasion, the speaker was Dick Cheney. This was before he was vice president, so at that time we knew him as the former Secretary of Defense. And he spoke for a while, and there was a Q&A time. And during that time, I can't remember what the question was, but in his response, he made a statement. He said, "One thing that should never happen is American soldiers should never serve under foreign command." Okay, so the audience showed their agreement to that. I was not surprised that the audience agreed with that. What did surprise me was that it was a strong reaction. I mean, people are applauding loudly, you know, they're behind that statement. And I'm looking around like, okay, what's that about? Because my sister's husband, he had served in the Canadian Armed Forces. And the main task of Canadian Armed Forces is to go on peacekeeping missions with the United Nations. And so he'd served under foreign command a number of times. And I didn't think that that was a big deal. But evidently for this crowd here, you know, on that particular night, it's a big deal for them. Somehow, in their thinking, you know, there's a different reality with the United States in the world. Okay? And so the United States has to operate a little bit differently. You know, it's not like any other country. And I'll just say, even after all this time, I actually still don't really understand that reaction. So at the end, if you want to explain it to me, I'm still curious to know. So let's start with the Roman Empire, because it was the reality of most first century Christians. And I'm hoping that I can leave a little bit of time at the end for some discussion or questions or whatever, but that's my intent. We'll see if we can do that. So Rome was a powerful political force that had conquered the Mediterranean world and then beyond the Mediterranean. It was a powerful economic force, so that even cities beyond the Roman Empire wanted to trade with the cities of the Roman Empire because there was money to be made. Okay, powerful economic force. It was a powerful cultural force, with its huge spectacles and religious rites that were pervasive, and just its sensibility about its religions, its cultural values. There was no way that Christianity could simply be neutral about the Roman Empire. Right? That was not possible. And there's two sides to this for us as we look back. Because on the one hand, we look back and we see that Rome really had so many impressive achievements in terms of great architecture and Roman roads that made travel possible. Things that it did to advance law and the understanding of law. But on the other hand, Rome is known as a great oppressor of Christianity, and sometimes a very brutal oppressor. And that started with the Emperor Nero and continued for 250 or so years after that. Okay, so think about the United States now. The reality of people's lives today is that United States dominates on the world stage. And like Rome, it is political, and it is cultural, and it is economic. China is being talked a lot about these days because its economy is growing so rapidly. And so there's talk about it eventually surpassing the United States, and it's becoming a rival. But China has nowhere near the political and cultural impact on the world that the United States has. Nowhere close to it at this point. Growing up in Canada, I witnessed the powerful impact of American culture with just television. Because American shows would come into the U.S. and there were Canadian TV shows, but it was so hard for them to compete when you had, you know, cool shows like when I was growing up, like The A-Team and Miami Vice. How can you compete with stuff like that? And so, you know, we definitely felt the impact of American culture there. Or more recently, when the United States had the mortgage crisis that contributed to bringing down the economy. You know, in Canada, they had very different rules for banking. And so they did not have a mortgage crisis. But the United States is just so big. And when its economy fell, I mean, it took Canada with it. And they were having to pick up the pieces. Even though, you know, Canadians might say this wasn't our fault, but still, they've got to live with the reality. Okay, so how do we relate Rome's effect on its world and on individuals to America's effect on people today, including us? Is America another Rome? Or does America have better and higher ideals than that? Was Rome just about naked greed and power? And is America better? So, here are four things that are said today. And this, these are said despite the fact that people recognize America has some ugly spots in its history. I think everybody's aware of that, you know, that there are some spots that we don't like, you know, whether it's treatment of the Indians or whatever it might be. But here's some summary statements that I hear made about America's impact on the world. Okay, so one is that America has helped maintain peace in the world. Another one, America has brought prosperity to many parts of the world. Okay, and that has to do with trade and American companies going overseas. Overall, America has been a force for good in the world. And again, that does not deny that there are some parts of American history that we don't like, including America's involvement with other parts of the world. And then America's status means that it has special responsibilities in the world. Okay, that America cannot be just like any other country. It in some way is obligated to lead and to take responsibility where other nations would not feel that. Now, what is interesting about those statements is Rome would have agreed to each one of those. Okay? So Rome brought peace to the world. That was one of its great achievements. Rome brought prosperity to many parts of the world. Trade and through the ease of Roman travel. Overall, Rome has been a force for good in the world. Rome knew that it had its own ugly black spots. But still, they would say overall, we have been a force for good. And then the last one, that it had special responsibilities in the world, okay, to lead and to govern well and to look after the general welfare. Okay, so some of what I'm looking at then has to do with a whole, it's almost like a whole field of New Testament studies that has cropped up over the last 20 years or so that looks at how the New Testament directly or indirectly challenges the Roman Empire. Okay, and I'll show you just a few books just to get a sense of it. And some of these don't have a very high res, so they may be a little fuzzy. But The Roman Empire in the New Testament, An Essential Guide, that's a book by Warren Carter, who's written a lot in this whole area. God and Empire, and the subtitle there at the bottom, Jesus Against Rome, Then and Now, by John Dominic Crossan. Come Out My People, God's Call Out of Empire in the Bible and Beyond. Apostle to the Conquered, Reimagining Paul's Mission. That is looking at Paul's whole mission. You know, think of it, you know, read what he's saying in light of the fact that he's talking to people who are under Roman domination. And does that change the way that you see some of the things that he's saying? I'll just make a quick mention about something too. I don't know how well you can see the picture there, but you have a man who's putting the beat down on a woman. That is Emperor Claudius, who was the emperor who finally was able to subdue Britain. And the woman is Britannia, who is the personification of Britain. And that's apparently One way that they would talk about Roman victory was these images of a male emperor beating up a woman, which is grim, I think. Then you get into some books where they're looking specifically at a New Testament book and reading it in reference to empire, you know, really looking closely. And so this one is one that has been popular, Colossians Remixed, Subverting the Empire. Another one, The Arrogance of Nations, Reading Romans in the Shadow of Empire. So this is the tip of the iceberg. It's just amazing, I mean, how much is being published in this area. And one concern that all these books have is, okay, then what about us? What about us where we are today in our situation? How does it relate to us? And I'll just mention one more book, because there is one that tries to take a fair and even-handed look at some of this stuff. So Jesus is Lord, Caesar is Not, Evaluating Empire in New Testament Studies. And, you know, my looking at it, I think it's a pretty fair consideration of the whole field. And I appreciated it. This book here echoes kind of what I've felt, in that it is skeptical about some of the claims that are made, thinking that some of the scholars are overreaching a little bit. However, they're still making some really valuable contributions to our understanding of the New Testament. And I'll give you an example of one where I think it's overshooting. And this is Warren Carter, who, again, has written a lot in this field. He talks about the story in the Gospels where Jesus and his disciples cross the Sea of Galilee to the land of the Gadarenes. And when they get out of the boat, there's a demon-possessed man. Jesus asks, "What is your name?" And the demon says, "Legion." And Warren Carter points at that. He says, "Aha." Because here you have a man who is living under the oppression of this demonic force. But that name points at something else. And when Caesar wants to subdue a territory, what does he do? He sends Roman legions to dominate and oppress. The liberation that this man experiences from this demon is also pointing at a liberation that everybody who lives under Roman rule is eventually going to experience, because sometime, at some point out there, Jesus is going to bring Caesar down. Well, that's a fresh way of reading that story. But a couple problems. One is that legion can just mean many. It doesn't have to mean a military force. And the other thing is, if the story is about that, I don't see anything else in the story that points in that direction. I only see that one thing. So that's what I would consider an overreach. I think that there are valuable contributions that these scholars are making. The biggest thing that is talked about in this area, I think the thing that has gotten the most attention, has to do with language. And the fact that the New Testament writers use a lot of language, they use words that are being used elsewhere to talk about Rome and Roman power and Roman achievement. Okay, and so I just want to look at some of that for a moment. So one word is empire or kingdom, which is the same word in the Greek. So you have the Roman Empire, and here comes Jesus proclaiming that the kingdom of God or the empire of God is at hand. And you wonder if that would make Roman authorities a little bit nervous. Election. Okay, God has elected us to eternal salvation. For Rome, they were elected by the gods to be the great power and empire that they are. Okay, so you see that word used by Rome. Even a word like father, one of the designations or descriptors of Caesar was that he was the father of the fatherland. So even with things like that, Savior was a designation that was used for Caesar, and especially Augustus Caesar, because up until Augustus Caesar became emperor, there was so much conflict and civil war in the empire, and he saved the world by putting a stop to those things. And that's going to come up in more terms that we look at. Good news or gospel. If the Roman armies have had a great victory, then from the Roman authorities, they will send out a message. It is a gospel or good news, and it goes out to the provinces, and it tells the gospel of this great Roman victory. Salvation. Salvation is the stability, the prosperity, the well-being that has come with Roman rule. That leads to one of the great achievements. Again, I mentioned this earlier, one of the great achievements of Roman rule is peace, that there was a cessation of conflicts in so many different parts of the empire. And you know, obviously in the New Testament, you know, the Apostle Paul will start so many of his letters by saying grace and peace. All right. Then another great achievement of Rome is justice. Romans were very proud of their system of justice because they felt that it was a system that was more fair for all people. The realities of their system, you know, they had their inequities, and I think the rich got a better shake in their system, which we know some of that today for ourselves. Even a term like faith. Faith was a very important word for Rome, because faith was something that Rome showed to the people. Okay, it was loyalty, but the people also needed to show towards the Roman emperor. Okay, so it was a mutual thing. And then Lord, or sometimes Lord of all, we see both of those with Jesus, that he is called Lord, or he is called Lord of all. We also see both of those with Caesar. That term is used for Caesar and who he is. Okay, so there's more that I could talk about, more terms that we could look at. But you look at that list, and I mean, there's some remarkable things that you see on a list like that. And especially when you look at it, I mean, some of those terms like, say, salvation or savior, or faith, you know, we think of those as religious words. But back in that day, they were not religious words. They were words that were used popularly and to talk about political and Roman realities. Are the New Testament writers using these words to overtly oppose Rome? Maybe at some points. But I think more often what we see is that these words do indirectly challenge Roman authority, Roman thinking about themselves in the world. One of the things that they do is that they do show that Rome wants to claim a status and a power for itself that God has not granted to it. That's a pretty significant thing. Now, the problem for us as Americans, that when we see terms like this, is you know, the fact that so many of them are religious terms, and so they wouldn't, for us, provoke at some of our issues, you know, the ways that we think about America. And America in the world. You know, they don't do that. And so maybe you just have to get creative on your own and think, okay, what if Jesus came proclaiming that the superpower of God is at hand? You know, might that cause us to sit up and think a little bit differently about what Jesus is about? Or what if it was God's chosen nation is at hand? You know, what if we imagine Jesus saying that? What if the great body of believers was not called a church? What if it was called the Jesus Party? You know, like a political party name. What if that was our term for the church? How would things like that challenge our identity and our idea of what we think really matters? Okay? What that word list shows us is that these terms are being used to create a new way of talking about this new reality, this new existence in Jesus Christ. And it doesn't ignore Roman ideology, right? It doesn't ignore Roman thinking. But it's taking these terms to talk about something that is greater and higher. And clearly, you know, when Jesus is called Lord, I mean, that makes Caesar subservient to Jesus Christ. You know, you can't avoid that implication. But I would point out that we don't want to get into making a category mistake. And that is that the New Testament is pretty clear about saying where the ultimate battle is being fought. And the battle is not between Jesus and Caesar. I mean, the ultimate battle is between Christ and Satan. And then does that mean that that doesn't have anything to do with Caesar? No. Caesar's definitely a part of that. And the realities of Caesar and what Caesar is about with sometimes violent brutality and oppression of people and this incredibly overinflated sense of who Caesar is and what Rome is. But we have to keep it in view that behind this, there is a bigger war going on. And one of Caesar's mistakes is he doesn't see the big war going on between Satan and Jesus Christ. So one of the things that I'm going to do tomorrow is I'm going to look at a fairly big New Testament passage and think about how Roman thinking at the top affected relationships between people and in families. Okay, and then get us to think about our relationships today and what some of the implications are. And so that's the direction I want to move. But I want to go ahead and share one story just to get us thinking in that direction. Several years ago, in a sermon at Caldwell, I told a story about a woman that I had known growing up. And through my teenage years especially. This woman was a gentle, kind, just incredibly forgiving and loving spirit. Just a wonderful woman. And I admired her. And particularly I admired her because she was married to a very difficult man. I don't think he ever abused her, but there were many times where he was just not nice. He would be difficult to live with because he would make big decisions that affected the whole family, but he wouldn't consult with her. You know, so she was just kind of swept along with some things. He was just kind of emotionally cut off So wouldn't make himself vulnerable to her. I mean, you could see that in, even in their interactions in public. And she was so incredibly patient with him. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe he needed somebody who would be tougher with him. And maybe she was behind closed doors. Who knows? But I never saw that. I just saw her show incredible forbearance with him. And so as I told about her in the sermon, I held her up as an example. And for me, as a heroic figure. Well, apparently, it didn't go over so well with some people. And particularly, there is one woman in our church who was upset by me telling that. She did not think that it was a good story to tell and hold up this woman as an example. And so, you know, I'm curious about this, and I'm trying to find out why. And I came to realize that for her, you know, two things that she saw there, two things having to do with power and justice. And one was that this woman had accepted a situation of powerlessness, and that she had accepted a situation of injustice. Okay, and those are obviously closely related. And she thought that was troubling. Okay, and I didn't address that when I talked about this. Now, I would say I was talking about power and I was talking about justice. But it's a different kind of power. Or it's a power that operates through weakness, the kind of weakness that we see in Jesus Christ. It's a different kind of justice. Okay, you think about God's people looking forward to a Messiah who is going to bring justice, and for them that meant revenge upon their enemies. And the justice that Jesus the Messiah brought was a justice where he laid down his life for sinful people. And so when we see some things like that, you know, the kind of things that come into play, then we're, that kind of points us in the direction of, you know, how does this actually affect us personally, and how we think about our relationships, and how do we see, you know, big ideologies and ways of thinking that come down to a close personal level. All right? Again, I really want to dig more into things in that direction tomorrow when we get together and ask just some questions then about how do we resist the dominant ideologies of our day. Ideologies particularly that have to do with power, because power plays an important role in how we think about our world and ourselves in the world. Okay? So I'm just curious, comments that you want to make at this point or questions?
This is a great conversation to have. I just wonder, since the church was birthed into a Roman world and America was birthed into more of a Christian world, and it's a different context in the sense that I see most of the people I work with have their faith and their patriotism so mixed together that they're not sure where one ends and one begins, or that they're even different things. I see that as more, so much more troubling than anything else. It really bothers me. It really troubles me.
I know, and I hear this from people. I mean, that's a really big concern, and it does make it different. I mean, particularly because, you know, the stories that is often told is, you know, we're unique in the world in that we were born as a Christian nation, and so our core and what we're about is Christian, and it makes it tougher for us because, like you're saying, the early Christians did not live under that illusion. And so for us to find some ways, like I was trying to do with shifting the terms a little bit, you know, the superpower of God is at hand, to find some ways to, you know, get us to sit up and think about this, Yeah.
That's good.
Are you going to talk about what influence the Roman government had on the first century church when Rome accepted Christianity?
Yeah.
What happened in the church and what impact did the Roman government structure have on the church?
I'm not going to talk about that, but that is a really big issue that obviously, again, impacts us today. So yeah, you're thinking about the 300s with Constantine. And when he legitimizes Christianity, and then in short order, Christianity doesn't just become okay, but actually becomes the official religion of the empire.
If you look at Paul, when he describes what an elder and a deacon should be, coincides real closely with what a Roman officer should be. And some of the rules and restrictions. So I think the Roman government had a great impact on the church's form of structure.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. In a lot of ways, you see the culture of the time impacting New Testament.
We'll discuss tomorrow, early American Christianity had a great impact on the former.
Yeah, in the back.
I was thinking, in the New Testament, the Bible kind of holds a tension. There is both the view of Rome as the keeper of the peace, which is true, and that sort of thing, and Paul and Peter have his lapel. But there is a certain amount of submission that goes with that. But at the same time, it's also pictured in Revelation as the beast and the Satan beast. And I think it's hard to live in that tension even now. Mm-hmm. To be able to speak of our own country in the same way, both a provider of good and in some sense necessary, but also elements of the beast in there. And I think, in the same way that in the past we maybe not spoke about the Holy Spirit as we should because we were afraid of Pentecostals, we today maybe don't speak as critically as we often should because we're afraid of liberals, because most churches are more conservative and the people in them. And so I think we have trouble living in the tension. We really want it to be one way or the other, and it's hard to live.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get what he's saying, that Revelation takes this very strong anti-Rome position. I mean, it's pretty stark what is being said about the emperor as the beast and what's going to happen to Rome when it comes crashing down, and trade, and merchants are going to weep when it all goes down the tubes. So, I mean, that's a strong line, but you have more, I guess, what some people would call accommodationist positions in 1 Peter and Romans, and particularly in Romans 13. Okay? And so there's great variety in the New Testament about this, and how do you understand that? One thing that, one way of understanding some of the more accommodationist is that the Jews did have a past of learning how to get along under foreign empires. And I think the book of Daniel is a great example with that. You know, where Nebuchadnezzar acts like a goofball sometimes, and yet Daniel respects him, and yet consistently holds to his faith, without apology. And so Daniel negotiates the issues that are there. 1 Peter and Romans may reflect some of that. Okay, anybody else? All right. We're good for today. We'll meet back tomorrow.